From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, the Syrian government threatens to quit peace talks in Switzerland as the talks' ambitions are scaled back.
I hope that all three parties, the government, the opposition, and the United Nations, would be up to the task.
Also, Al-Qaeda militants claim responsibility for a string of attacks in Cairo. Political battle on Capitol Hill over long-term unemployment benefits intensifies. So does the fight for journalistic freedom in China. And the Venezuelans who say the country's crime wave is forcing them to flee to Florida.
You don't see a future for your children. They should become professionals. And they find that the future doesn't look bright in that sense.
That's ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From feature story news in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. United Nations envoy Lakhdar Brahimi has announced that Syria's opposition and government will meet in the same room on Saturday as part of the continuing peace talks in Switzerland. Mr. Brahimi appears to have averted the collapse of the negotiations after threats from Damascus to abandon the process. The two sides have been blaming each other for a lack of progress. Lorna Shadek reports.
Lakhdar Brahimi seemed confident that neither side will walk out of the talks in the coming days and predicted they'd continue for another week. He said all sides understood that the conference is trying to save Syria. Mr. Brahimi spent 3 days trying to get the parties to meet, an encounter that was scheduled to happen for the first time this Friday. But instead, Mr. Brahimi met government delegates in the morning and the opposition in the afternoon. After a day of frantic negotiations, the two sides did agree to talk in the same room on Saturday, though it's still not clear if they'll face each other in the meeting or sit separately, with Mr. Brahimi shuttling between them, what's known as proximity talks. Diplomats say that when the parties do get together, they're now aiming to work on small concessions, including local truces rather than one overarching peace agreement.
There's chaos in Cairo. At least 6 people have died, with 100 more injured after a series of bomb blasts outside police stations across the city. Security has been on high alert in anticipation of the 3rd anniversary of the Arab Spring Uprising, which is coming up on Saturday. Tension continues to grow between military coup-led government forces and Muslim Brotherhood supporters. In Ukraine, protesters erected more barricades overnight in the central streets of Kiev. The opposition leaders rejected the government's terms to end the standoff as crowds gathered on Independence Square voted to withdraw from talks. The negotiations to end the political crisis, however, are set to continue as the opposition demands the government step down over a canceled integration deal with the EU. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
New barricades appeared overnight on Kyiv's central streets, where rioters protect the tenth city on the Maidan or Independence Square. The opposition leaders rejected the government's terms to clear the city streets in exchange for a ceasefire and a promise to free the arrested activists. The sides, however, agreed to extend the truce reached on Thursday to avoid violence. The Maidan Self-Defense Unit representatives claimed to have seized the building of the Agrarian Policy Ministry early on Friday morning to give people a warm shelter. The Ukrainian government called for an emergency session of the country's parliament, Verkhovna Rada, on Tuesday next week. Prime Minister Mykola Azarov said his government will be ready to step down if the parliament decides so. The opposition demands the cabinet and the president to quit over an unpopular decision to withdraw from an association deal with the European Union.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. has warned against doing business with Iran in an apparent bid to dispel impressions the 6-month nuclear deal with the isolated nation means business as usual. Administration officials have stepped up calls on U.S. companies not to sign any contracts with Iran until after the 6-month nuclear agreement expires in July. Nina Maria Potts reports.
The U.S. says all sanctions against Iran remain in place, warning companies to hold off doing business with Iran until the 6-month nuclear agreement is up. The U.S. Treasury Department, meanwhile, has announced a $152 million settlement with a Luxembourg-based banking subsidiary of Germany's Deutsche Börse Securities Exchange for allowing Iran to bypass sanctions by using the subsidiary's access to U.S. banking systems. The Treasury said the move should serve as a reminder to companies not to do business with sanctions sanctioned parties. The administration has come under mounting criticism from U.S. lawmakers opposed to the six-month nuclear deal. It was meant to give Iran a window of time to negotiate a more permanent deal. Critics say the agreement, which came into force on Monday, gives away far too much to the Iranians. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
And parts of Britain flooded in last month's storms and tidal surge might have to be abandoned to the sea forever, according to officials. The UK's Environment Agency is now in talks with nature bodies about which areas might be left to wildlife. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Parts of East Anglia might not be reclaimed from the sea, according to Paul Leinster, chief executive of the Environment Agency, the man in charge of protecting the UK's coastline. Around 373 acres of land are still underwater towards England's east coast. The Environment Agency says it now has to decide whether to reinstate some flood defences or allow fresh wildlife habitats to establish themselves. It's now in talks with conservation organisations about which areas should be left for wildlife.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin tonight in Switzerland, where the Syrian foreign minister today threatened to quit peace talks after a round of face-to-face negotiations with the country's rebels failed to occur. Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN envoy chairing the talks, says government and opposition delegates have agreed to be in the same room as one another over the weekend. But the Syrian government says it will pull out of Montreux unless what it calls serious negotiations begin. Kate Fisher spoke to Laura Rosen, who is covering the peace conference for the news website Al Monitor.
It kind of got off to a rocky start because there was an expectation among some Western diplomats last night that the two sides, from the Syrian regime and the opposition, would sit down with the UN envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, today and start to sort of figure out their agenda for the week. But when we woke up this morning, it turned out that Brahimi had decided to delay that. So he met separately, first with one and then the other, and then gave us his press conference tonight. The outcome of that, he said, was that the two sides had agreed to sit down tomorrow together in the same room for the first time and again on Sunday. And it seems like he is expressing kind of very cautious encouragement that the two sides understand what is at stake and they don't want to walk away from the process, even though their differences are really bitter and huge.
So although it may seem to the outside world that not much progress was made today because they wouldn't go in the same room, you're saying actually you are cautiously optimistic.
I mean, there's been no substantive progress in terms of narrowing the differences between the two sides. They're just not there yet. But in terms of it seems like a teeny bit of resilience to the two sides seeming to want to at least stick out this week and figure out what the agenda might be for ongoing peace negotiations that will be very bitter. It seems like that is something that they've realized. And that's not, it's not just Western spin. That's not nothing. They haven't talked for 3 years. There's been no peace process at all. So that that they're starting one and that it's rocky is encouraging.
And they're talking about making perhaps smaller concessions initially.
I think they're talking about parallel tracks. That one would address humanitarian issues like what you're saying, like localized ceasefires and prisoner exchanges. And the other one would look at the political transition. It's very sensitive for the opposition when you talk about a humanitarian track, because they're afraid that they're going to get basically deceived and that they're never going to get the regime side to talk about a political transition. So Brahimi made very clear today that it's not going to be humanitarian first. It's going to be parallel, right? Because the opposition feels like they're putting a lot on the line to come to these negotiations, and they need that kind of reassurance.
So just take us through what will happen tomorrow, the first time that these two sides have sat down in the same room and actually talked.
Well, I imagine it's going to be very frosty, and that even though they will be in the same room, they will probably be, not intermingling, sitting next to each other, but at separate tables with Brahimi going between. I think it's going to take several days just to agree on a basic agenda and schedule. It's really quite sensitive to go into the substantive details yet, and it is going to take a long time.
That's Laura Rosen, and you can follow her reporting from Montreux on the news website Al Monitor. This is FSN Reports. There was fresh violence in Egypt today, a string of suicide attacks that killed six people and wounded more than 100 others. The blasts targeted Cairo's police headquarters, the city's Museum of Islamic Art, and a well-known movie theatre. And they took place on the third anniversary of the uprising that ousted President Hosni Mubarak from power. FSN's Lorna Shaddock spoke with correspondent Catherine Stapley, who is in Cairo.
Now, it seems that an explosive went off as a convoy of trucks carrying security personnel drove past. They were coming back from dispersing a protest of some 2,000 supporters of the ousted Islamist president Mohamed Morsi. And there were clashes between security forces and the protesters. And the attack happened as the security forces were coming back from those clashes. Now, the Sinai-based Islamist militant group Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis has claimed responsibility for the first attack this morning. And they've also issued a statement warning people to stay away from squares in cities across the country tomorrow, which of course marks the third anniversary of the January 2011 revolution that ousted Hosni Mubarak from power.
What's the atmosphere like there, particularly in Cairo where you are? How are Egyptians feeling about all of this?
Well, immediately after that big blast happened this morning, the first one, some people who support the police and the army actually went to the scene outside the main police headquarters there. And they were shouting slogans in support of the police and the army. They were also pointing the finger at the Muslim Brotherhood, saying they were responsible for those attacks, shouting things like death to the Brotherhood. But of course, tomorrow is the third anniversary of the 2011 revolution. And what the army supporters and the supporters of General Sisi are planning is a big celebration in Tahrir Square. Now, currently, it's sealed off by the army, but tomorrow, that's where they're planning to hold that celebration. And interestingly, it's the Minister of the Interior who has called for those celebrations to take place there. Now, tomorrow, too, the Muslim Brotherhood led Morsi supporters and separately the secular activist groups are saying they're going to protest against the military-backed government.
That's Catherine Stapley in Cairo. As Congress took a 10-day vacation this week, more than 1.6 million Americans who have been jobless for 6 months or longer were cut off from receiving federal unemployment benefits. As new data shows a sluggish economy adding far fewer jobs than needed, Democrats in Congress and President Barack Obama face an uphill battle in their push to renew the Emergency Unemployment Benefits Program. From Washington, FSN's Alice Alstein reports.
It's been nearly a month since Congress allowed benefits for the long-term unemployed to expire, sending more than a million Americans, including 52-year-old Pennsylvania resident Helene Larisavich, spiraling.
I've sent out 126 resumes for specific job postings. I've had 20 interviews with another one scheduled for Monday, but still no job.
Since her job was outsourced last spring, Larisavich has exhausted her allotted 26 weeks of state benefits and has gradually been depleting her family savings.
Without a renewal of federal jobless aid or a new job, by the end of February, our savings will be extinguished and we'll have nothing left to pay the mortgage. We will then lose our home.
As the number of long-term unemployed people like Larisavich climbs above 4 million, more people continue to become newly unemployed. New data from the Labor Department found that 325,000 people filed for first-time unemployment benefits last week, about 1,000 more than the week before. They also report that only 74,000 jobs were added nationwide in December, far less than the more than 20,000 jobs added in each of the previous 4 months. And for those with jobs, average hourly wages also fell by 0.3% in December. Amidst this grim outlook, Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed says he and other lawmakers pushing for swift renewal of the Emergency Unemployment Benefits Program that expired in December continue to face stiff opposition.
Unfortunately, on our side, a significant number of Republicans are resisting this, and if they continue to do so, by the end of this year, that total number of Americans won't be 1.6, it'll be over 3 million.
Reed introduced a bill that would renew the program for 3 months, giving Congress time to find a way to fund it long term. But lawmakers have still not reached a deal to even hold a vote on that bill, something New Jersey Democrat Rob Andrews called unconscionable.
There was time to pass a bill that requires the people implementing the health care law to file a report once a week that they're already filing once a month. There was time to authorize the Peace Corps Commemorative Foundation to establish a commemorative work of art. There was time to pass a bill that changed the boundaries of the Gettysburg National Military Park to include the train station. The idea that we could consider bills like that and turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to the concerns of 1.6 million Americans like Helene is just unconscionable.
Before Congress left for yet another recess last Friday, backers of the unemployment benefits renewal voiced hope that lawmakers would be bombarded by voters back in their home states this week and would return to Washington on Monday motivated to pass the bill. Andrews says this has been true for him.
I've heard all over my district from all kinds of people that they're at just about the point where they're going to step off the cliff. This is the first month they'll miss the mortgage payment. This is the first month they won't be able to make the car note. This is the first month that a student loan obligation won't get paid back. This is the first month their credit will be at risk. I've heard this from hundreds of people.
Though lawmakers say they want to tackle the unemployment benefits issue as soon as they return to D.C. next week, it's currently missing from the calendars of both the House and the Senate. In Washington, I'm Alice Holstein.
Now to China, where it has been a very difficult week to be a foreign correspondent and an even more difficult week to be an activist opposed to official corruption. Zhu Zhiyong went on trial this week, accused of organising protests against high-level corruption within the Chinese Communist Party. The US is demanding his immediate release, saying the Chinese government should work with those trying to root out corruption, not put them in the dock. The case attracted a great deal of global attention, but foreign correspondents seeking to cover it found themselves harassed by Chinese security agents, in some cases live on the air. FSN's Kate Fisher reports.
They're physically manhandling me. This is the public space. I'm allowed to report.
This is the sound of court reporting in Beijing.
We are reporting in a public space.
CNN correspondent David McKenzie is kicked, punched and bundled into a van by Chinese security. His camera is broken.
You cannot physically manhandle us. We're having some trouble here from the police. They're pushing the camera away. Why are we not?
The BBC's Martin Patience was live on air when he was manhandled away.
I'm just staying with you. Excuse me. This is the kind of trouble you get covering Chinese trials in China. It's incredible, the harassment and intimidation.
Also pushed around live on air, Sky News' Mark Stone. He then questioned his attackers.
Why can't I report this? I'm allowed to be here. We are allowed to report here. Why are we not allowed to report this? Why am I not allowed to stand here?
But they are allowed to report it.
What was particularly disturbing is that that was a clear violation of the Chinese government's own regulations governing foreign correspondence in China, which say that we can report anywhere in China except Tibet. And we're free to talk to anybody who is ready to talk to us.
Beijing correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Peter Ford, is also president of the Foreign Correspondents Club of China.
Well, the Foreign Correspondents Club of China has written a letter to the foreign ministry, who are our interlocutors, protesting about this and asking them to ensure that the authorities do abide by Chinese law and Chinese regulations. We'll have to see what sort of response we get. But this is not the first time this sort of thing has happened. And I'm afraid it won't be the last. But it's quite unnecessary. And to be honest, I think it probably drew more attention internationally to the case of Zhu Zhiyong and his civil rights campaign than he would have got otherwise.
Why am I not allowed to stand outside?
Certainly the actions of the Chinese pushed the story higher up running orders across the world, and videos of the reporters being pushed around have gone viral.
Harassment you face in the country.
But Benjamin Ishmael, head of the Asia-Pacific desk at Reporters Without Borders, says there should be more public criticism from international organisations.
think strong and general condemnation of these actions are needed urgently, not only from the organization of the civil society, but from governments, from international organizations such as the European Union, from the UN. And not only condemnations and public statements have to be made, but also solutions, answers, concrete answers have to be found by these key actors to on the international scene to tell China to that it cannot violate press freedom and freedom of information without any consequence.
You could see a gentleman here from the police is actually trying to stop us from doing what
his concern
we're doing
is that
now.
The longer this aggression goes unchecked, the more frequent and violent it may become.
Try and explain if you could still hear me.
It's really worrying because it really shows that the regime is ready to increase and has the means actually to increase its control of information and will not hesitate to resort to violence to muzzle the free press.
Scant comfort for the hundreds of journalists simply trying to do their job of telling the story of this enormous, secretive and evolving country. Kate Fisher, Washington.
Political leaders in Venezuela are trying to figure out ways of tackling the country's epidemic of violent crime. It follows the recent killing of a former Miss Venezuela, Monica Spear, and her ex-husband. They died when assailants opened fire on their car. President Nicolas Maduro recently met with governors and mayors to discuss the crime wave. As FSN's Steve Mort reports from our bureau in Miami, many Venezuelans there cite the ongoing violence as a reason for leaving the country.
At home with his family in Hallandale Beach, Florida, Paul Harriton is one of about 260,000 people of Venezuelan origin in the United States, the majority of which are immigrants.
The people who left are people with economic means.
Harriton is an architect and property developer in the Miami area. He moved to the U.S. 12 years ago. He says he, like many other Venezuelans who leave their country, wanted better economic prospects for his children.
I think the future for them was much better here. It's a big loss for the country because all my friend kids who are here and going to Harvard and Yale and Stanford and they're going to be great professionals here instead of going back, as I did. I went to school in New York and I graduated and went back to Venezuela and worked there for almost 30 years. And that is lost. That won't happen again.
Figures show the Venezuelan population in the United States has more than doubled in the last decade. The U.S. government attributes that rise to concerns in Venezuela over the weakening of democratic institutions, political polarization, and rampant violent crime.
A large part of my family lives in the United States.
Pincus Brenner left Venezuela 2 years ago. He says fears over personal safety push many middle-class Venezuelans to leave, and not just for the United States.
Many have moved to other Latin American countries like Colombia, Costa Rica, Panama. There is just no security in Venezuela. You go to Caracas, and after 6 o'clock in the evening, you won't see anybody in the street. You see very few cars that venture out because they have to do something extremely important. Many people have bulletproof cars that didn't exist before the Chavez years.
But the immigration patterns in Venezuela tell a nuanced tale. The International Organization for Migration says Venezuela has, in fact, traditionally been a receiving country of migrants from around the world, particularly from Colombia, Spain, Italy, and Portugal. The organization says many migrants travel to Venezuela for opportunities in the country's petroleum industry. Others, like Colombians, seek refuge from armed conflict. The IOM also points to Venezuela's efforts to integrate migrants. The World Bank says between 2009 and 2013, 40,000 more people migrated to Venezuela than left the country. But those now in the U.S. say the figures mask a brain drain taking place in Venezuela. Pincus Brenner says he sees a pattern of educated families leaving the country while lower-skilled workers arrive.
You don't see a future for your children. You want to educate them. They should become professionals, and they should make a fairly decent living, secure living, with social benefits, with hospitalization and so on, and they find that the future doesn't look bright in that sense.
But international migration agencies predict people from around the world will continue to arrive in Venezuela despite personal security concerns. The country's economy grew 5.6% in 2012, faster than many Western nations, and the World Bank predicts modest growth going forward. Steve Mort, Miami.
And finally tonight, if it sounds like a plot from a movie, that's because it is a plot from a movie. In December 1978, a group of masked gunmen seized $6 million in cash and jewels from a cargo building at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. The so-called Lufthansa heist became immortalized in the mob movie Goodfellas. And yesterday, Vincent Asaro, a 78-year-old allegedly with mob ties, was charged with playing a role in the crime. Joining me now from FSN's New York Bureau, our correspondent there, Ira Spitzer. And Ira, what led to the sudden break in the case, and what role did Mr. Asaro allegedly play in the heist?
Well, the big break in this case seems to have come in 2011, when Asaro was taped allegedly complaining to an FBI informant that he never got his cut from the Lufthansa heist. Now, supposedly, each person was supposed to get about $750,000. But of course, many people involved in this crime seem to have turned up dead. The figure is at least 8 people connected with the case have turned dead, and that may have been as high as 15. That according to FBI agent Steve Carbone, who was supervising the case. As far as Mr. Asaro's alleged role, the filings do not specify exactly what he may have done in the actual robbery. However, they do specify that he was involved both in planning and in carrying out the robbery. So it seems that Asaro, they think he was a very important person, perhaps the second most important person to Jimmy the Gent Burke. That's the character played by Robert De Niro. Now, Burke died in prison in 1996. But Asaro was a high-level planner and was also on site for this robbery, so an extremely important arrest for the FBI.
Now, the indictment reads like a mafia mystery novel, including even a dead body being dug up from the foundations of a home. Does it look likely that further arrests are going to be made?
Well, Asaro's arrest was part of a pre-dawn raid by the FBI where they arrested Mr. Asaro as well as 4 other people, including his son. So it seems like this is a very coordinated arrest on the part of the FBI. All of the people arrested were part of the Bonanno crime family. So at this point, it doesn't seem that there will be any more arrests.
And this heist at JFK was pretty pugnacious and bold back in 1978. What's the reaction been in New York to Mr. Asaro's sudden arrest?
Well, there's been an intense interest both on the part of the media and the general public here in New York since the news of Mr. Asaro's arrest was announced. And you can't overstate the impact of the movie Goodfellas in creating interest around this case. Mr. Asaro's lawyer, Gerald McMahon, even acknowledging the movie in some of his comments to the media yesterday. McMahon joking that Scorsese must have needed a sequel. So there's really an intense interest in this case, and that interest will continue. It sounds like it will be going to trial. Mr. Asaro has pleaded not guilty, says it's going to go to trial. So expect to, you know, if that happens, expect to hear a lot more about this case in the coming months.
And that wraps up another week of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the program. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. A word about next Friday's edition of the program. I'll be in San Francisco at the headquarters of Google for a Google Plus hangout with President Barack Obama. He'll take questions from people all over the country about the initiatives he'll discuss in Tuesday's State of the Union address. We'll have that for you next Friday on FSN Reports and, of course, full coverage next week of the State of the Union itself. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster at the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.